Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Some of you might have noticed that the Pentagon once again thinks a nuclear war might be winnable after all. Perhaps that might also be a reason our neurotic president trades schoolyard taunts with a Persian Torquemada. The bully has the bomb, and he threatens to atomize the Shiite out of getting one. I dedicate today's program to the memory of the Three Stooges, to whom violent slapstick was mere comedy. Their current imitators, Pompey, Bolte, and Trumpy, elicit shudders rather than giggles with their nuclear farce. I'd like to begin the program with something I wrote. I guess I can call it No Such War as a Good War. And might as well give the disclaimer that it's my opinion, and perhaps my opinion in all of the cosmos, plural, plural, and plural. The world never seems able to take off its war helmet. One can sense an almost palpable relief among world leaders who are always ready to mobilize their militaries for war in the familiar old way, rather than deal with the sigilous uncertainties of peace, however rarely it looms in the political geography. And it is instructive to note how quickly propaganda machines respond to the most recent dire crises, erasing ambiguities of everyday civilization to explicate nasty contrasts devoid of shades. Extremes overpower dialogue as war hawks maneuver ideologies for battle. It is us against them, good versus evil, black and white, the only acceptable colors of public conversation. Prejudice, always waiting with its intolerant leer, leaps into the dialogue. Enemy Asians were gooks, current slurs in the USA to describe diverse peoples in the Middle East are ragheads and desert. Demonization of an enemy is common and ancient. The enemy are vermin or subhuman and represent ant-like civilizations that are offensive to the true God and national interest. Decimation of an enemy is the goal. Dehumanizing an enemy is the policy. Extermination is the method. Little sympathy is shown in enemy's combatants, and in fact, civilians whose deaths or injuries are explained as unavoidable are also considered complicit. The purpose of any war doesn't essentially matter. Each is the same as any other. Someone desires to extend power through violence. Others attempt to check contemporary grabs for power and implement their own in counterpoint. History is the register of the strife of authorities, French philosopher Bertrand de Jouvenal wrote in his book On Power, The Natural History of Its Growth. Always and everywhere man takes possession of man, to bend him to his will and adapt him to his design, so that society is seen to be a galaxy of authorities which arise, grow, and fight each other. And that was Jouvenal. Or as Jonathan Swift wrote in a letter to Bolingbroke in 1729, "For I will venture all I am worth that there is not one human creature in power who will not be modest enough to confess he proceeds wholly upon a principle of corruption." The people who advocate for war are generally ideological conservatives whose inspired historical vision is that perpetual warfare, most often pretext in classic rubric of religious or patriotic crusade or jihad, is the means to expand and protect the home country or father/motherland, a sort of messianic mission with a faith-based foreign policy of a most explosive kind. War demands action as well as spectacle to maintain its momentum on the field and support at home. War also limits the prerogatives available to attain the real justice an armed crusade seldom provides. A distinction between so-called just wars and unjust wars, a distinction made in medieval times by the Christian Church to justify its incessant religious wars, is equally or more important in regard to a war's conduct as it is to a war's rationale. The main distinction is the prohibition of intentionally targeting non-combatants in a war to be considered a just war. Nor should disproportionate force be used. We heard President Donald Trump use that particular phrase recently. Yet, as the wholesale bombings by both sides in World War II and many instances afterward indicate, such as the aerial echo side of Vietnam, the differences are too often degrees of propaganda rather than reality. Total or unconditional war is not only the prerogative of military organizations, but also of any ad hoc guerrillas or insurgency who struggle against them, however horrible and catastrophic the results. In a total war, everyone is a soldier, which was the ultimate rationale of the mass bombings of cities in World War II, and certainly the use of two atomic bombs on two Japanese cities, which was the nativity of the nuclear age and its iconic mushroom cloud that has billowed over humanity since. Once an enemy is proclaimed as evil, and every enemy is, the other enemy assumes itself as the obvious, self-fulfilling, just or righteous antagonist of a war, which complicates the adage of saints marching in every time there is a war. All too often, atrocities are committed in a war not because the perpetrators are blatantly evil, but because they perceive evil has been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable or saw as fitting. A major perception of every war is that it is either irrelevant or justified what we have done to others. What matters is what has been done to us, which is essentially dealt with as though mutual atrocities occurred in a moral vacuum. Homefront patriotism, whether near or far away from a war, is fervently stage-managed, a yellow-ribboned war agitation that demands universal support for the troops sent into a war, even though doubts are raised among the citizenry about the purpose or rightness of a war. No matter how anyone might regard a war's intent or conduct, anyone not cheerleading for the troops is rather speciously made publicly suspect for lacking proper public spirit or, more sinisterly, accused of disloyalty or treachery. Protest against mobilization and subsequent war is severely undermined by schizophrenic war cheers for the warriors. Movements for peace, whether inspired by the sense that war is a tragic farce or that belligerents should use every opportunity to settle accounts short of war, are continually put on the defense by war hawks to prove patriotism through affirmation of support for those engaged in what war opponents condemn and openly protest. Even venerable religious doctrine that urges forgiveness of the sinner, though not the sin, does not make such a demand. To forgive a sinner at least acknowledges a crime. Contrarily, citizens who oppose a war are stridently coerced to separate their antipathy for a war by publicly approving of the troops, distinct from what they actually do. Consequently, support of the warrior is, of course, distorted into abject support of the war. And in converse, criticism of a war implies disavowal of the soldiers, which is insinuated to be betrayal of the troops. That is rather like saying one can deplore the deed but praise the doer. In a sense, taking offense against the killing should not interfere with cheering on the killers to continue killing. There is no little spherically schizoid deviance at play here. After all, a majority of people will generally support a war once it starts, if for no other reason than they feel there is little recourse otherwise. That support is considered essential by war makers, whether offensively or defensively, and is primarily focused upon the soldiers, who are not responsible for the wars they fight, but who make them possible. ultra-patriotic war fervor is continually flogged to discourage questions of a war's necessariness and to disguise the contradiction that supporting a soldier's warlike duty is a sure method of killing him or her. Paradoxically, this leaves soldiers with little recourse but to carry out what they perceive to be the public will until they are wounded or die. The anti-Vietnam War protest movement learned that key premise as surviving disaffected veterans returned home from the war and joined them in vigorous dissent, and they began to demand stop the killing and maiming of American soldiers, in addition to Vietnamese, who were perishing in uncounted numbers, far surpassing even the inflated body count that was the war's measure. The only real method of supporting the troops of any armed force is to remove them from harm's way and bring them home alive and unhurt, even if that means putting an end to a war. Of course, the war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is the true patriotic act and a more sensible method of supporting soldiers than dispatching them into horror. Perhaps after a war is finished and the shocks of its costs and consequences numb previously regular rally around the flag frenzy, many citizens might wish they had been more sympathetic and supportive of voices of protest they scorned or even denounced as traitors. How empty, how sickish, how senseless everything suddenly seems when a war is over, Edmund Wilson once wrote. The magnificently irascible Ambrose Bierce, who was born 3 days and 177 years ago on June 24th, 1842, and who has been reputed to be the only writer of stature to have fought on either side in the Civil War, defined war in his famously infamous The Devil's Dictionary. War, noun, a byproduct of the arts of peace. The most menacing political condition is a period of international amity. The student of history who has not been taught to expect unexpected may justly boast himself inaccessible to the light. In time of peace, prepare for war has a deeper meaning than is commonly discerned. It means not merely that all things earthly have an end, that change is the one immutable and eternal law, but that the soil of peace is thickly sown with the seeds of war and singularly suited to their germination and growth. And that was Ambrose Bierce defining war in his Devil's Dictionary, which was published in 1911. And a last word from the late Howard Nemiroff, World War II veteran and poet laureate of the USA, who wrote in his 1989 collection of poems, War Storiers, "The reason we do not learn from history is because we are not the people who learned last time." And now, I would like to read something written by an old friend from many moons ago, when we both knew each other at Portland State University and protested the Vietnam War. "Whatever Happened to Moral Capitalism," by Michael Kazin, who now teaches history at Georgetown and co-edits Dissent, and he's writing the history of the Democratic Party. It has a slug, "Democrats used to embrace strong markets and strong government. They should do so again." What kind of economy do Democrats believe in? Joe Biden calls for stronger labor laws and a tax code that rewards the middle class. Bernie Sanders wants to raise taxes on the rich and guarantee every adult a job. Elizabeth Warren has a slew of plans that include giving employees seats on corporate boards and breaking up giant firms like Facebook and Amazon. Kamala Harris urges a big tax cut for ordinary families and stricter penalties for companies that cheat their workers. And that's a quote. Recent polls show that the public is increasingly supportive of proposals like these. Yet no one who hopes to become the nominee has yet to come up with a larger vision that would animate such worthy ideas. and without an inspiring way to tie them together, they may come across to voters like items on a mediocre takeout menu, tasty enough but forgettable. So let one loyal, if anxious, Democrat offer a solution: moral capitalism, a system that, in the words of Congressman Joe Kennedy III of Massachusetts, would be, quote, judged not by how much it produces, but how broadly it empowers, backed by a government unafraid to set the conditions for fair and just markets. It is a goal that, by different names, national Democratic leaders have articulated since the party first emerged almost two centuries ago. They understood that most voters liked the general idea of a market economy in which they would have a fair chance to rise, but also resented an economy that failed to live up to the rosy promises of its defenders in business and government. The tradition began in the 1830s when Andrew Jackson vetoed a renewed charter for the Second Bank of the United States, declaring, "It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the axe of government to their selfish purposes." Grover Cleveland renewed the offensive in his attack on the protective tariff in the 1880s, as did William Jennings Bryan in his crusade against the money power at the end of the 19th century, and Franklin D. Roosevelt in his assault on economic royalists in the 1930s. For all these Democratic leaders, moral capitalism was an aspiration for a system that would balance protection for the rights of Americans to accumulate property and start businesses with an abiding concern for the welfare of men and women of little or modest means who increasingly worked for somebody else. That vision did combine two distinct ways to critique the existing economic order and campaign for a better one. One tendency hurls a harsh critique at concentrated power, whether in high finance, manufacturing, the federal government, or the perceived alliance between private wealth and private capital. It envisioned a society of small proprietors, or at least of a government that strictly regulates big businesses and compels them to redistribute part of their wealth. The second kind of moral capitalism fixes on the oppression of Americans on the job, whether by poor working conditions, low wages, insecure employment, or a ban on union organizing. Its defenders seek to unite wage earners and their sympathizers and look more kindly on those employers, no matter how large, who respect the rights of their employees and pay them well. In theory, the two tendencies are not contradictory. Both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders criticize monopolies like Walmart for dominating the marketplace, as well as for paying poor wages to workers and resisting attempts by their workers to organize unions. But historically, which of the two tendencies the Democrats espouse has defined the kind of coalition they strive to build? The anti-monopoly theme dominated during the first century of the party's history, from Jackson's rise in the 1820s to the start of the Great Depression of the 1930s, and helped make the Democrats a national party. During that period, the party either ignored the rights and needs of non-white people or actively sought to keep them in bondage or in manifestly unequal status. This period had a long run because it united such disparate social forces as white Southern planters and Irish Catholic immigrants around a shared animosity toward Northern industrialists, high finance, and high tariffs. In the 1930s, the pro-worker theme largely replaced the anti-monopoly one, and it was central to the Democrats' message through the 1960s. The main driver of the change was a labor movement that quintupled its membership during the Great Depression and the Second World War and became the party's indispensable base from Franklin Roosevelt to Lyndon Johnson. For a time, it seemed as if the pro-labor vision of a moral capitalism could become an American version of social democracy, although it was more effective as rhetoric than policy. In his 1944 State of the Union address, Roosevelt proposed a sweeping program that would have guaranteed every American the right to a job, a home, and medical care. But a coalition of Republicans and Southern Democrats blocked legislation to secure any of his grand objectives. From the 1970s until the start of the Great Recession, liberal politicians and activists tended to downplay the tropes of moral capitalism. They had some sound reasons for doing so. Roosevelt built a multiracial coalition that would have amazed and alarmed Andrew Jackson. Yet most party leaders still defined working people as a noble assemblage composed solely of white men and their family members. The political earthquake of the black freedom and feminist movements demolished that bigoted assumption. The battle against racism and sexist laws and institutions quickly became central to what it meant to be a committed Democrat. In the current century, alarm about climate change and a commitment to LGBT rights have been added to the top of the party's agenda. But in the past, creating an ideology of moral capitalism and a coalition behind it proved to be the most fruitful electoral strategy for Democrats to follow. Periods when they made persuasive arguments about the need to create and then preserve such a system were the only times when the party gained durable majorities. From the late 1820s until the mid-1850s, and again from the 1930s to the late 1960s. Of course, major changes have since transformed the nation and its politics. Still, a majority of Americans of all races, genders, and national origins continue to suffer from economic insecurity and have little control over the conditions of their work. A vision of moral capitalism would address that shared condition and suggest what changes could significantly improve it. In his 1944 address, Roosevelt expressed a confidence that, in retrospect, was too sanguine for its time. "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence," FDR declared. "We have accepted a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed." Democrats today desperately need to articulate a similarly clear-eyed, buoyant determination to build a decent society. Without moral capitalism or a powerful equivalent, they risk getting stuck in internecine fights while their arrogant adversary rekindles his vow to return America to a greatness he can neither define nor deliver. And that was Whatever Happened to Moral Capitalism by Michael Kazin, who teaches history at Georgetown University and is the co-editor of Dissent. And an old friend from Portland State University. And now I'd like to read something by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. Stupidity Run Amok. Prolific and cantankerous science fiction author Harlan Ellison concluded that the two most common elements in the universe are hydrogen and stupidity. I can't argue with that sensible conclusion, since we Americans are currently awash in stupidity. Ignorance is the state of being uninformed and unaware in a world swarming with information, where people are too lazy to notice something. Stupidity, on the other hand, is knowing what is right and trying to find it in the wrong. Stupidity isn't the lack of knowledge, but the illusion of having it. An important distinction. Since the year 2000, we have endured one barely literate president, mega churches that insist that creation is 6,023 years old, an anti-intellectual climate that casts anyone intelligent as a suspected terrorist, and now Donald J. Trump, perhaps the least literate president in American history. Consider my quick take on several ongoing current issues. First, creationism. The junk science notion that there is an intelligent design, and that's a quote, that explains the origin of life. Despite Judge John E. Jones's December 28, 2005 repudiation of the Dover, Pennsylvania School Board's requirement that school children read of pandas and people textbook, creationists everywhere still insist they know the truth about humanity's origins. So, to find out why the Earth is just 6,000 years old, take a trip to the $27 million Creationism Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, where you will encounter a towering mastodon skeleton, frolicking vegetarian dinosaurs, Noah's Ark, and other fanciful displays that arm children and childlike adults against the atheist indoctrination of evolution, quote, unquote. In their 1955 play, Inherit the Wind, Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee featured a cross-examination of fundamentalist Matthew Harrison Brady, representing William Jennings Bryan, by Henry Drummond, representing atheist and famous lawyer Clarence Darrow, played by actors Frederick March and Spencer Tracy, respectively, in the movie version. Drummond maneuvers Brady into a claim that creation occurred on October 23, 4004 BC at 9 a.m., with Drummond inquiring whether that was Eastern Standard or Rocky Mountain time. A sad criticism of a leading progressive, highly regarded presidential candidate and God-fearing man who, in that instance, turned his back on the truth. And that would be Matthew Harrison Brady. Consider the ongoing so-called debate about climate change. Despite overwhelming everyday evidence that man-induced global warming is occurring with a 97% consensus among scientists, many Americans believe it's a hoax. That's stupid with a capital S. Recall loony neoconservative Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe happily holding a snowball before his colleagues, insisting that there's no such thing as global warming. Of course, he parlayed his stunt on February 26, 2015 in Washington, D.C., so he probably failed to disprove his climate change, forgetting the difference between weather and climate. Trump and his anti-immigration cohorts insist that flooding our borders with armed troops to ward off hordes of desperate but dangerous women and children is the right policy, along with building that wall. Incarcerating children in cages and separating families is construed as an urgent and justifiable policy, albeit supported by bile-spewing demagogues run amok. Need I remark about the many male anti-abortionists who insist that a fetal heartbeat indicates life that must be protected and that doctors performing abortions should face up to 99 years imprisonment? Let's not allow women to have any say about their own bodies and instead permit men to determine when life begins and how to deal with it after birth. Considering that we Americans are currently awash in a swamp of lunacy, illiteracy, and stupidity, it is wise to remember that the universe will never run out of hydrogen and stupidity. Since our president proudly declares that he loves stupid, poorly educated Americans, asinine enough to buy his tripe, I find it really difficult to feel upbeat about our future. Martin Luther King maintained that nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. In his book, Letters and Papers from Prison, German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer railed against stupidity, declaring, "Stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice. One may protest against evil. It can be exposed and, if need be, prevented by use of force. Against stupidity, we are defenseless." And that was Bonhoeffer. Agreeing that stupidity is just as destructive as evil, short story author Jim Butcher argued that what we really need is a crusade against stupid. That might actually make a difference. I hope so. And that was Dr. Robert Brake, Stupidity Run Amok, and he lives in Ocean Park, Washington, and a former college professor. This is Michael McCusker. On this date, June 27, 1898, Joshua Slocum became the first recorded human to circumnavigate the world solo when he and his sloop Spray landed in Rhode Island. He had sailed more than 46,000 miles around the globe. His book, Sailing Alone Around the World, is one of the world's great books and a damned good read. And speaking of books, Also on today's date in 1922, Hendrik von Loon received the first Newbery Medal for Excellence in Children's Literature for his book, The Story of Mankind, which he also profusely illustrated. Van Loon wrote and illustrated several books for his grandchildren. And take my promise, they are great reads for elders also. And Helen Keller was born today in 1880. I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my duty to accomplish small tasks as if they were great and noble, she wrote. And just after midnight tomorrow, June 28th, is the 50th anniversary of the 1969 Stonewall Riot, when patrons and sympathizers resisted a police raid of the storied gay club in New York City. The riot, as it is called, has become a defining moment in the struggle for equal rights for gay and lesbian Americans.